the chess world in a show with everything but Yul Brynner. Time flies, doesn't seem a minute since the Tyrolean Spa had the chess bars in it. All change, don't you know that when you play at this level, there's no ordinary venue. It's Iceland, or the Philippines, or Hastings, or...
Murray Head. That's One Night in Bangkok from Murray Head back in 1985 from the, well, it's an album and from the musical Chess. Introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Head. We like to analyze important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to talk about persecuting Christians in Pakistan via Way of Bangkok with Katie Chalk, who has written a new book, The Persecuted, True Stories of Courageous Christians Living Their Faith in Muslim Land. He's a contributing editor to the New Oxford Review and a senior contributor for The Federalist, as well as a contributor to the American Conservative and Crisis magazine. And he came into contact with persecuted Christians from Pakistan during his time from 2014 and 2017 in Bangkok, Thailand. So we want to discuss this very interesting, compelling book about these persecuted Christians and their experience in Pakistan and fleeing there to countries like the United States and beyond. Well, Casey Chalk, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, first starting out, tell our listeners here, how did you come to know about persecuted Pakistani Christians, and what were you doing in Bangkok from 2014 to 2017?
Sure. So I had some familiarity with the plight of the persecuted church through when I was in Protestant seminary. I had a professor who was a convert from Islam who had written a number of books on the topic. Patrick Sukdeo, he's a professor of religion who sometimes comes to teach in the United States, even though he's in the United Kingdom. But when my wife and I we had one daughter, and we moved to Bangkok, Thailand. I was managing a organization that did translation work for a number of different clients. But the Catholic parish that we attended in Bangkok, I noticed right away that there was a very large South Asian community, and I thought that was very strange because of course Bangkok's very much an international city. You'll find people from all over the world there, but it was very surprising how many South Asians there were, and I wanted to sort of get a better understanding of that. I had previously served working with DOD in Afghanistan, so I was able to sort of, you know, recognize them and speak their language a bit. And getting to know them, I realized that there was actually this hidden crisis of persecuted Pakistani Christians fleeing to places like Thailand and then getting stuck there for years. You know, and many of the folks that I knew there, and when I left 2017, they're still there today.
Well, okay. Well, what did you do for the Department of Defense in Afghanistan?
Oh, that was also translation work. I have background with Dari language.
Oh, interesting. Linguistic background there, knowledge of Pakistan, the whole Afghanistan area. Well, why do such Pakistani Christians, why do they and other refugees wind up in Bangkok? I mean, you say it's this international city.
Yeah, so Bangkok, like, you know, sort of like the song that you led with, you know, sort of suggests location, right? A very large percentage of the Thai economy is based on tourism. And so they're very welcoming of people from around the world, even from, you know, places like Pakistan and other Muslim countries. So Pakistani Christians who are suffering persecution in their native country, they, you know, they learn about this through, you know, human traffickers and friends or family that have already made the trip. And they know that if they go to Thailand, they show up at that airport, they don't have to do any visa work before they arrive. And the Thai government will give them a 30-day visa upon arrival, right, under the presumption that they are there strictly for tourism. Of course, these Pakistani Christians have barely any money, and their one hope is that they will be able to apply for refugee status. The UNHCR, which is the UN Human Commissioner for Rights, has a very large office in downtown Bangkok, so they apply for refugee status. What they often don't know is that process usually takes at least a year, if not more, and the vast majority of the cases that are processed are denied. And then they're stuck. They're stuck in Thailand. They have no way to get home. They have no money to pay for a return flight to Pakistan. They certainly would rather not go back anyway. And so they end up getting involved in all kinds of things. A lot of them work illegally on the Thai economy. The Thai police hound them because they're there illegally, and the Thai police take advantage of this situation by basically doing raids periodically. They go to the churches or to people's homes. They round them up. They put them in what's called the International Detention Center, or IDC. And then the Pakistanis get stuck in jail for long periods of time until, you know, sometimes these Pakistanis have friends that they've made at the churches, Westerners, who have some money and are able to pay bail to get them out. But, of course, then the process starts all over again.
Well, that's interesting. So it's just as a tourist destination in Bangkok, it's easy entry. You know, you get in without a visa for 30 days, and once you're there, you can kind of disappear. So that's the easy entry, just get in quick. Bangkok, you know, Thailand being so dependent on tourism, they just want to bring people in, not really check people, and then you can hide from that. Well, that's very interesting. Well, you write of Christians in your book, suffering in Pakistan in particular, and in other Muslim countries around the world, is Islam a religion of peace, as many people have said in recent years?
Well, certainly there are many Muslims that are practitioners of peace, but places like Pakistan and some other countries in the Middle East and North Africa are very unwelcoming, very unfriendly towards Christians. Pakistan is a particularly egregious example, and there's some historical explanation that's needed there. Actually, it goes back into the 1980s when the U.S. government sponsored the Mujahideen, who were the freedom fighters fighting against the Soviet Union when it invaded Afghanistan. And these Mujahideen, they were freedom fighters fighting against the communist power, but they were also motivated by their Islamic faith and a desire to return Afghanistan to a pure Muslim state rather than one, you know, governed by atheist communists. So a lot of these Mujahideen fighters, they would basically hide out in the mountains of Pakistan. And this, over time, meant that a lot of the more extremist Muslims who adhered to, you know, forms of Islam like Wahhabism, which is funded by the Saudi government, ended up in Pakistan. And they didn't just stay in the mountain regions. Over time, they started to trickle into the big Pakistani cities like Lahore, Karachi, even Islamabad, the capital. And they basically became part of Pakistani society. And whereas Pakistan originally had been very welcoming towards Christians when it was founded, when India and Pakistan broke apart, when the British left in the 1940s, over time Pakistan has become much more aggressive towards Christians as these more extreme Islamic parties and groups have become more powerful, especially in places like Karachi, where many of these Christian communities, historic Christian communities, have been living for centuries.
Oh, interesting. So Karachi, the main port of Pakistan, I guess from what I know of Pakistan, a lot of Christians are Punjab. I mean, the assassinated governor, Shahbaz Bhatti, who had voiced opposition to Pakistan's notorious blasphemy laws, was the governor of Punjab, assassinated a decade ago in 2011. You say that then there are also a lot of Christians in Karachi as well.
Yeah, that's right. I have a chapter in my book, The Persecuted, that's devoted to talking about a lot of the violent incidents that have happened in Pakistan, mostly speeding up in the late 80s and then becoming especially egregious since 9/11, as, again, another round of Afghan extremist fighters, you know, fled from Afghanistan when the U.S. and NATO forces entered into places like Karachi and Lahore. So, yes, there have been a number of major attacks, suicide bombings in Lahore as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about purifying Afghanistan, these mujahideen, they want to have a pure Islam. But, you know, Pakistan, as has been noted by many, in Urdu means a land of the pure. And so after Indian partition in 1947, you had this whole idea of Indian partition was that Muslims of the Indian subcontinent, they needed to have this specifically Muslim country. Was secular government ever possible in this country of Pakistan, which has sort of this original ideology? I mean, even going back to 1949, when Pakistan had to draw up a new constitution, they proclaimed an Islamic Republic of Pakistan, the so-called objectives resolution that the new independent Pakistani parliament passed to draw up a new constitution for the post-British, post-imperial independent Pakistan, said that Pakistan had to be this Islamic state. So was any sort of secular government possible in Pakistan, for that matter, in any other post-imperial, post-colonial independent Muslim countries?
Yeah, you raise a very interesting question, Andrew. I mean, Pakistan, people are familiar with the flag. You know, it's a green background. It has a thin white strip, and that white strip is supposed to represent religious minority groups, which is a nice gesture. But alternatively, I think you are, noting a very concerning trend, which is that if we go around the globe and we look at countries which identify as Muslim, right? Like you said, it's in their constitution, it's in their laws, it's deep in their culture. These are majority Muslim countries. You would be hard pressed to find any that do not have at least laws that explicitly marginalize, if not persecute, Christians, make it impossible for Christians to spread their faith. Many make it difficult for them even to build new church buildings. And then of course there's also just the cultural and social pressures that are placed upon these people. Pakistan in particular, most of the Christians are involved in the lower social economic order. Many of them actually are converts from the untouchables and other lower classes. So they're already socially marginalized, and then Christianity just adds another layer of resentment and animosity towards them. And of course there's the long history with dhimmitude, right, which is this idea that Christians in Muslim countries are of a dhimmi class, and they need to pay some sort of tax in order to be, well, under the auspices of being protected by the Muslim state. But really, it's another way to sort of exert social and financial pressure on these vulnerable communities.
Yeah, you had this poll tax, the jizya, as it's called, for these dhimmi, these so-called protected people, subjugated peoples, non-Muslims in Muslim societies. And you indicate in the book, for example, Asia Bibi, this young woman in 2009 was accused of blasphemy in Pakistan, this Christian. She's noted in one of her memoirs that Christians in Pakistan are often called, if I'm pronouncing it right, a chori, which basically means people who clean toilets. Now, does Islamic doctrine hold that Christians are dirty? I mean, I note that there's both this discrimination in Pakistan, where Christians often end up, say, doing sewer work, cleaning toilets, like hotels do not want to employ Christians or kitchens, as well as in Egypt, you have similar discrimination where Christians often end up picking up trash, being trash collectors in Egypt. Is that Islamic doctrine that non-Muslims are dirty?
In certain senses, yes, there is a sense of uncleanliness on a couple of factors. One is, food and drink, right? So Islam rejects pork, it rejects alcohol, and those who consume those things are unclean. So yes, in that sense, you could certainly say they're dirty. There's also the perhaps more important and theological sense of the way that the God that Christians worship is a God who died on the cross. And for Muslims, that in and of itself is just shameful. It's reprehensible. How could the God of the universe be subjugated to men and suffer this ignominious death, ridiculed naked on a piece of wood? And so that also is viewed as dirty. And I talk in the book, in The Persecuted, about some examples, some of which are historical. You know, when the Muslims recaptured Jerusalem from the Christians during the Crusades, they dragged a cross through the streets of Jerusalem and stepped and spat on it to demonstrate the fact that they viewed it as an unholy and an unclean item.
Yeah, I've heard that before. For example, going back to V.S. Naipaul's books, the late V.S. Naipaul, West Indian writer from mixed Indian background in the Caribbean. He did these two travel logs, in first in 1979 and then in 1983. The first one was Among the Believers, and the second one was called Beyond Belief, where right after the Iranian Revolution of 1979, he visited these lands of what he called these lands of the converts to Islam, the people that had been conquered by these Arab Muslims to Islam, Iran, and then Pakistan, as well as the countries of sort of greater Malaysia, as it were, Malaysia, and then Indonesia, these Malay peoples. And he talked about how in Malaysia in particular, dealing with the Chinese population in Malaysia, they also drink alcohol and pork. And he wrote about, Muslim Malays there coming into some of them coming into contact with Chinese who eat pork and drink alcohol. They would express the sense of dirtiness, like they don't want to touch these people. So it's interesting. It's sort of like, you are what you eat. This doctrine in Islam that pork in particular is very dirty, very disgusting. And so if you eat that, then you're a disgusting person too.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. And in a lot of Muslim countries, you can't even acquire pork, right? I did a internship in Uganda, which is not majority Muslim, but it has a very large Muslim population, and they control the meat industry in the country in order to ensure that pork is not very accessible. And of course also that the food that is sold in the markets and whatnot is halal. But yeah, there's pressures even to affect what kinds of food and drink products people in their countries can even get access to. Of course, there's a lot of hypocrisy there. From my world travels, I know that in a lot of these Muslim countries, even though it's illegal to acquire alcohol, many wealthy Muslims who will have servants, oftentimes not Muslim servants, they'll be Christian or Hindu or something else, who they'll basically send off either to parts of the country where they do serve alcohol because there are Christians or other religions, or they'll go out of the country to purchase their alcohol so they can consume it in the privacy of their own home.
Uh-huh, right. So, okay, so you get the non-Muslims to get your little vice going there. Well, that's very interesting. You also noted in your book that Christians in Pakistan and other Muslim countries, they'll often, say, be seen as outsiders, and they'll suffer, say, like, if you have some sort of Western military action, like precisely as you indicate, Americans going into Afghanistan after 9/11, that they'll then suffer because of that. So are Christians in these Muslim countries like Pakistan, are they seen as the enemy?
Yes. Yeah, I think that I don't certainly don't have much interest in sort of rehashing, debating, the global war on terrorism or U.S. foreign policy. But I think it's very clear that whenever the U.S. government or other Western nations have bombed Muslim powers or invaded them like we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, that the Christian populations in those countries, or even other Muslim countries that are neighboring or not even neighboring, suffer the most, because Muslims basically blame the Christian populations for what's happened. Right? It's an easy, it's an easy victim, a scapegoat. Right? So if you're a Pakistani Muslim and you're really angry about the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, and then you know that there's some poor Christian community on the other side of town, then they can become sort of the target of your frustration that those infidel Americans have invaded Iraq or are stationing troops in Saudi Arabia or what have you.
Well, that's interesting. And looking at the plight of Christians in Pakistan, again, I mentioned this notorious blasphemy law, of course, that has a death penalty actually for blasphemy. And you write about, again, the case of Asia Bibi, who is prosecuted under this law, and only after sort of a 9-year ordeal, pronounced innocent by the Pakistani Supreme Court. But you note in the book that the the Reverend John Joseph, the Catholic Bishop of Faisalabad, the first indigenous or first native Pakistani Catholic bishop in the country. He committed suicide in May of 1998, and this was because of the protest, the execution of a Christian who has been falsely accused of blasphemy. Has Pakistan ever executed anyone under this blasphemy law? I personally have not. I'm not aware of any particular executions, although I know of sort of vigilante killings of Christians and others in Pakistan because of the effect of this blasphemy law.
I'm not sure that anyone has actually been executed under it, but yes, you're right that vigilantes have killed a number of Pakistanis who cite the blasphemy law as the reason why the Christians have to be lynched and murdered. Certainly, there have been attacks on Christians as well while they've been in prison for the blasphemy law. The case of Bishop John Joseph is a very sad one. Of course, I don't endorse suicide even when suffering under great persecution, but I think that does point to how desperate a lot of these Pakistani Christians are. In the case of Asia Bibi, that's the one that elicited the international headlines, attracted the attention of many heads of state, attracted the attention of Pope Benedict the 16th. And eventually it took, good Lord, it took, like 10 years. Eventually Asia Bibi was able to get out of the country. But I think probably a lot of Americans and other people living in the West think that Asia Bibi was some sort of anomaly, right, an unusual case. But as the stories of a number of the families that I met in Thailand show, this is actually very common. It's very common for Pakistani Muslims to falsely accuse Christians of violating the blasphemy law, sometimes just out of spite. Or there's some sort of conflict in the community. Sometimes it's simply motivated by a desire, like you said, like the word Pak meaning pure, to cleanse a particular town or village of any traces of Christians.
Yeah, you know the incidents you relate in this book of the people you met in Bangkok, Thailand, and their stories. It just shows that these Pakistani Christians that have fled. The stories are amazing about how people in Pakistan are really hunting them down. I mean, these people are changing neighborhoods, or they go to Bangkok for several years and then they go back to Pakistan, and, some imam will see them again and will chase after them. They'll be assaulted, suffer burnings and so forth. In particular, you note the one case that apparently there was a story in Thailand that some Pakistani Muslims had actually gone to Thailand to hunt down a Pakistani Christian, and they kill them there. This is just really extreme hatred, a hunting down of Christians here.
Yes, the hatred is it's difficult to imagine people having so much anger and vitriol towards other people, especially those who haven't even done anything to them, which is the case for the two main families that I describe in The Persecuted, which is the family of William Wilson and Michael D'Souza. Both of them are they're great men. I've spent 3 years getting to know them and their families. Very devout Christians. They just want to be left alone. They just want to do their work and be left alone to worship, to worship the Lord in peace. But just relentlessly hounded by Muslim extremists and all kinds of terrible accusations and attacks against them. Wilson, one of the leaders of the family, the leader of I think when I left Thailand there were 17 members of the family living in Bangkok by that point. His older brother, who was a medical doctor in Karachi, he attracted the attention of Muslims. You can also imagine what kind of the resentment that poor Muslims in Pakistan might feel towards a successful Christian doctor walking around them. So one day they basically cornered him. They shoved a book in his hands. He didn't know what was happening. It was actually the Quran. They had ripped out pages of it, and then they took pictures of it and videotaped it so that they could accuse him of having desecrated this Quran, which, again, would the punishment for that, would at least be imprisonment, if not death. And he had to be basically quickly hustled out of the country and now lives abroad in the Netherlands.
Yeah, well, speaking of Christians, I personally also met Pakistani Christians a couple of years ago. About 6 years ago, I wrote about a Pakistani Christian, an Anglican, came and visited here in the United States and gave a presentation on life in Pakistan for Christians and related very similar stories. One thing, I guess a sidelight here, a tangent to your book, how do these blasphemy laws and this persecution, how does it affect other non-Christian communities in Pakistan, like Hindus and so forth? I remember this Christian saying that, you know, they would engage in maybe evangelization among Hindus in Pakistan, a small Hindu minority in Pakistan, but of course they would leave Muslims alone because it's so dangerous.
Yeah, I don't know as much about the other religious communities in Pakistan and what sort of persecution or marginalization they suffer. I know that it's very marginal, the other communities. I think that the Pakistan and a lot of these Islamic parties have done a very good job at running a lot of these people out of the country. And so, yeah, people continue to flee, not just Christians, but Hindus, Sikhs, and other religious groups are no longer safe there. And like you said, there's forced conversions are widespread. Some of them are – it's really just diabolical and terrible what these extremist Muslims will do. You know, they'll kidnap young girls from their families and then, you know, have some sort of quick marriage that's blessed by a local imam. And Muslim law is such that, hey, once you're married, you know, that's the man is the one who gets to decide if there's a divorce. And so then – they can. They basically just they have the paperwork, and they're able to demonstrate that these young women are their wives, and the families are trapped. They're unable to get their daughters back. And this is an unfortunate occurrence. It happens very frequently. And there are websites that listeners can go to that discuss a lot of these stories that are not reported very frequently in the Western media.
Well, I've heard of that. About that before, I contributed among others to, for example, the Robert Spencer's Jihad Watch, and there he's posted several articles discussing this whole phenomenon of what's called love jihad. What sort of doctrine is behind that you write in the book that Muslim men, they can sort of abduct young Christian women, teenagers, say, and they can have them. They can say that they're converted, and they can marry them, and then they stay as their wives. What sort of doctrine is behind that? Is that sort of like similar to, say, what we've seen with sex slavery with the Islamic State a couple of years ago in Mesopotamia?
Yeah, there are certainly corollaries with sex slavery. And these are a lot of these Muslim societies. Some have more secular and liberal laws, but many of them, like Pakistan, do not. They're very patriarchal and hierarchical societies, and women have very few rights. And certainly in the more remote rural areas, very limited access to education. And like I said, in Islam, the woman has no power or ability. At least for many forms of Islam, like the ones that are like the versions that are practiced in Pakistan, they don't have the ability to get out of a marriage. The divorce can only be actioned by the husband. A lot of it does originate from strands of Islam that have been there since the very beginning.
So it's very easy once you can sort of like maybe take a person captive and conduct some sort of sham conversion ceremony, or I don't know, maybe even you don't even need that. I mean, a Muslim man can indeed marry a non-Muslim woman, but I guess maybe it's very easy then for the man to say, oh yeah, she married me, and there's not really anything the woman says to deny that, say, no, I never married this guy.
Right. They have in a lot of the cases that I'm familiar with, the men have the paperwork, and it's legal documentation, right? So even if the parents find out where their daughter is gone, the husband and his family are the ones that have the documentation to prove that a marriage did take place. Like you said, the woman who is forcibly married doesn't even have to convert. But terrible, terrible things like this happen frequently. The other family that I mentioned, Michael D'Souza, his family, one of his sister-in-laws was abducted under similar circumstances to this. And she was able to flee from her abductors after she was forcibly married, and ran to Michael and his wife Rosemary's home in Karachi. She was wearing a burqa and a niqab and crying out that she had been forcibly married. And they were able to see bruising on her body, but they were terrified. They didn't want to open the door because they knew what would happen. And sure enough, her Muslim abductors came and and dragged her away, and they didn't see her again.
Yeah, or I guess, I mean, it's, yeah, you write about those cases, and it's just, I guess, you know, again, the man can just simply say, yeah, or maybe the culture also additionally would just say, you would not challenge her, maybe think, you know, this is good that these women now are going to be raised in Muslim homes, and maybe their children will become Muslim. So maybe there's just sort of a cultural prejudice that, you know, yeah, sure, this is just fine that now these infidels are being Islamicized.
Yeah, I think that dynamic is certainly in effect. Like you said, it's, you know, Christians who marry Muslims will never get to have the choice of raising their kids Christian in places like Pakistan. It's always the reverse. So, it is a way of sort of like slowly, you know, using marriage as a tool to undermine these Christian communities. And yeah, it's terrifying. It's especially in a country like the United States that we live right now, which emphasizes women's rights so emphatically. It's just amazing that there are countries where these things happen regularly.
Yeah, one interesting case, you're right, the first Pakistani conviction of a Christian for blasphemy occurred in 1991. And an interesting detail you provide there is you say that the judge attested that the accuser must be honest, must have been truthful, because he had a beard, and that indicated piety. What does the beard mean in Islam? Why is that so pious?
That particular story is risible, right? It makes you laugh, but it's just terrible. But yes, the beard, when I served in Afghanistan, a lot of the guys, you know, service members will grow out, you know, we grow out the Haji beard, as they call it. And what that refers to is when men go on Hajj, right, which is, you know, one of the five pillars of Islam, you know, they go to Mecca to pay homage to God there, and, you know, and do all the prayers and cleansings that go with it. They typically grow a beard. So growing out your beard is a sign of piety and holiness, and taking seriously the laws and practices of Islam.
Well, is that? I guess that's I've read that that's because as you write in the book, you know, Muhammad in Islam is considered this sort of perfect role model, pronounced like that in the Quran, and therefore. You want to wear a beard like Muhammad because he supposedly had a beard. So to wear that beard is a sign of piety.
Yeah. Yes. And unfortunately, you know, having Muhammad as the role model for a religion also results in a lot of other practices that I think many people, even liberals in the West, would find very disconcerting. I mean, Muhammad had many wives. He was a very violent man. The Quran, I mean, more liberal Muslims can't deny the fact that Muhammad was terribly violent, you know, basically, massacred his enemies, right? And if that's the template for piety and noble living, then, it's scary stuff.
Well, yeah, you note in the book that there's a doctrine, I mean, I guess this applies specifically to this whole issue of blasphemy and vigilantism, that there's a doctrine in Islam that individuals can uphold Islamic law, can take vengeance then in the name of Islam. I mean, we can think of like prominent examples globally, like, you know, the killing of the Charlie Hebdo cartoonist in Paris in 2015. If that's been actually a doctrine that an individual Muslim can sort of, as it were, take the law into his own hands and sort of uphold the honor or the standards of Islam.
Oh, yes. Yes, that is a doctrine that's taught. It's very widespread in different schools of Islam. And like you said, the Charlie Hebdo is one example. But yeah, there are many others. And this is another thing that differentiates Islam from certainly from the Catholic brand of Christianity, is that it's a very it's a more democratized form of religious practice, right? There is no Muslim Pope. There are many, many Muslim clerics who all have the authority to issue fatwas if they want. Now, of course, many other Muslims will, you know, basically say, well, that particular fatwa is not legitimate, and there's lots of fighting back and forth. But what that means is, you know, if you're a Muslim radical, you will not have a lot of difficulty finding some imam to issue a fatwa declaring, like you say, vengeance against some perceived insult or attack against the Muslim faith.
Oh, I lost the other verma. Yeah, you note in the book, you document, you list one particular fatwa from an imam for citing these cases of blasphemy, calling for the death of one of these individuals. So that is indeed very striking. Well, I guess that brings up then another doctrine, going back to this man with his beard being saying that he's really honest. Can such a Muslim lie for Islam based on doctrine that is often discussed of taqiyya, of deception of the name of the faith? I mean, you know, we have this judge here in Pakistan saying, oh, this man is very truthful because he has his beard, but could he be justified in lying in the name of the faith?
Yeah, there are circumstances under which Muslims are allowed to deceive if it does, further the cause of Islam, furthering its spread or defending Islam from attacks against foreigners. So there's a very strong current of ends justify the means mentality in many schools of Islam.
Well, I guess looking at some of these practices of Muslims that you talk about in the book, one interesting another detail that you talk about is that there's this one Christian nurse in a Pakistani hospital, and she gave an injection to a Muslim in a hospital. And he got angry because this supposedly broke his Ramadan fast. Is that a common belief that an injection will actually break your fast?
No, I don't think that is a terribly common belief. I think that was more just opportunism. Many Pakistani Muslims, their default perception of Christians is that they are dirty and they don't want them in their country and they don't want to have anything to do with them. So even the thought that, a Muslim patient would be in the hospital and be served by a Christian woman is, and especially, you can imagine a Christian woman who, perhaps he can see her hair, right? And maybe she's wearing a cross necklace or there's some other way to designate her as a Christian. It's offensive. It was terribly offensive that she would even be in the same room and providing medical care to him. So, yeah, so he comes up with this ridiculous thing about, you injected me with something during my Ramadan fast, and this is a great offense against me. And, like I said, it's not difficult to find some imam. Oh, there's some charge against a Christian. Where do I sign? And then able to, exact vengeance upon her. And in that case, that's Wilson's wife, Mariam. She had to ultimately flee out of that hospital by a back door. And one of the family members chased them down as they were getting into a taxi cab outside the hospital and shot at them. And when they got to their final destination, there were bullet holes in the taxi.
Yeah, indeed, disturbing account. I mean, really living life dangerously here as a Christian in Pakistan. And another incident you bring up, you've talked about Muslim Pakistanis complaining about church bell ringing in Pakistan being too loud. That brings up traditional Sharia Thimi restrictions. We've talked about this Thimi status that historically there have been restrictions like Christians are not supposed to ring their bells too loud or pray too loudly. What sort of obstacles do Christians face in Pakistan in terms of, worship or building their churches or expressing their faith?
Oh, yeah. It's very difficult to build new churches or expand existing church buildings in Pakistan. The example with the church being too loud, that was actually a story that Wilson's priest, Father Thomas, who's no longer with us, he died a few years ago. He related to me when he came to visit them in Bangkok, and yeah, he explained how basically anything that they did at the church that had any kind of noise, there would be complaints, and the police would arrive and reprimand them for. Basically just trying to live their faith.
Mm-hmm. Whereas I guess, of course, on the other hand, in Pakistan or other Muslim countries, you had the Muslim call the prayer, the adnan from the muezzin, the caller, that can be as loud as you want, I guess, right?
Well, yeah, of course, right. I mean, yeah, if you've traveled at all, or your listeners have traveled at all in majority Muslim countries or with large Muslim populations. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to avoid hearing that call to prayer. Yeah, sometimes, you know, at 5 in the morning.
Well, you know, you deal with these refugees in Bangkok, Thailand, and, you know, one of the people you dealt with, one of these Christian Pakistanis fleeing said, you know, look, you know, these Western countries, long refugees, as it were, all these Muslim refugees, and they're all going to be just troublemakers in your countries. I mean, is that true? Are we applying the wrong standards in accepting refugees? Are we not taking in the right people?
Well, I've argued this in The Persecuted in a number of articles I've written for other publications, which is that, you know, surprisingly, even in 2021, given a lot of the cultural trends at work in the United States, a very large percentage of Americans still identify as Christian. So in that sense, I think and are very willing to say, you know, America is in some sense still a Christian nation. And if that's the case, then certainly we should be prioritizing those. But I think even for Americans who no longer believe that, who are, you know, more aligned with secular, liberal, progressive values, I think the priority needs to be for those people who are suffering the most and most under threat. And, you know, in a lot of cases, you know, these Muslim countries, yeah, certainly there's lots of very poor, marginalized Pakistani Muslims as well, but they are not suffering the kind of existential immediate threats to their existence that Pakistani Christians are. And yes, I think that, you know, what my friend Wilson and other Pakistani Christians have told me, that there is truth to that. A lot of the Muslims that have come into the West have caused trouble, caused all kinds of terrorist attacks. But, you know, not just them, but sometimes even if the parents that come over to the West and they mean well and they just want to be able to live quietly and have a better future in the United States or some Western country, their children, you know, experience a sense of dislocation, right? Because they're the children of Muslims from another country living in a Western land. And so they're more inclined to look to Islam to provide meaning and guidance for them. And many of the imams that they, especially in our digital age, many of the imams that they end up, you know, listening to and obeying are the more extreme ones. And yeah, so I think it's a generational problem. And it's a deep cultural one that I think we're going to face more of, especially in the West, in Western Europe, where, a number of these countries have increasingly large Muslim populations that, when it comes right down to it, their opinions of human rights, the role of women, religious freedom, free speech are radically opposed to the laws that are in place in Western nations.
Yeah, indeed, we've had notable examples of that. I mean, back in, I guess it was 2015, you know, the Orlando mass shooter at the Pulse nightclub, the gay nightclub. I mean, he was the son of a person from Afghanistan who had come here, as well as you had, I guess, about 2 years before that, or 1 year before that, the San Bernardino, California shooter. You know, a mother couple involved in that mass shooting, and they were also the husband, I believe, was the son of a person who had immigrated to the United States. So that is indeed a troubling trend of people who have grown up in the United States or other Western countries, they're the children of people who have come here, and they show that phenomenon that you've talked about, that they go through this radicalization, or people have often talked, they seek meaning and so forth, and they'll tap into these various dangerous doctrines here in the United States. Well, you know, you look at you talk a lot about your own personal troubles dealing with these refugees. You and your friends and people know you spent a lot of money trying to help these people. You know, sometimes that got wasted in really bad schemes when people took advantage of some of these Pakistani Christians. You know, how can Western countries make distinctions among a people applying for asylum in the United States or elsewhere?
Well, one thing I think that is required is a paradigm shift of the perception of what's really at stake here. So one of the examples I talk about in The Persecuted is when one of the family's cases, Michael D'Souza's family, his case was actually briefed to a congressional subcommittee a couple years ago. And one of the legislators on that subcommittee is Ilhan Omar. And when Michael D'Souza's story and the story of his family was briefed, Ilhan Omar's response was that, well, we really need to be focused on the persecution of Muslims around the world. Well, I just don't know what data she's looking at. Like, there's just simply no parity between examples of Muslims suffering persecution from Christians or Hindus or anyone else in comparison to what Christians are suffering and dealing with. So I think that some of it is just awareness. I think a lot of people just simply do not realize what is at stake here. The many thousands of Christians many millions of Christians, frankly, who are suffering around the world and facing real physical danger to themselves and to their families and really no opportunities to improve their livelihood.
Well, that's an interesting point you bring on the book that, maybe people in Western society, they think of Christianity, Christians being part of the establishment, part of the power holders. How do we bring this message across to sort of a woke generation that, as you've indicated in the book, Christians around the world are really suffering. They're really persecuted.
I think some of it is simply exposing people to these stories. I think The Persecuted does a very good job of sharing some of these stories really in intricate detail. And my goal with doing that was I wanted readers to be able to understand that, these people, they're not just statistics, right? To say something like, well, whatever the case might be, there's, a thousand, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but let's say there's 1,000 Christian women in Pakistan every year who are abducted and married to Muslim men. Okay, but that sounds pretty terrible, but, it's like Stalin said about, numbers. Sometimes they just become statistics that don't mean much. Whereas, what I intended to do with The Persecuted is go deep into these families' lives so that people can recognize their own lives in their stories, right? That these are their husbands and fathers who want just to be able to work and provide for their wives and children. These are stories about children who grow up suffering persecution from the very beginning of their life, some of whom have spent most of their lives living as asylum seekers in other nations where they oftentimes don't even have the opportunity to go to school. Or even if they are able to go to school, it's sometimes interrupted because they're detained by Thai police or authorities in other countries and suffer in detention centers for months, if not years at a time. So I think that we need to spread this message. I think the Persecuted does that. There's, like I mentioned, there's a lot of other great Christian publications online and in print. We talked about Patrick Sukdeo and his organization that, brings a lot more spotlight to these, to the ubiquity of these stories.
Yeah, Patrick Sudeo has founded the Barnabas Fund, a very important institution that gives aid to persecuted Christians around the world. Coming from your specific Catholic background, there's been a lot of talk of Pope Francis' outreach to Muslims around the world. Back in 2019, he signed this document with the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar University in Cairo, Egypt, this leading Sunni Muslim authority in the world in Abu Dhabi, this Abu Dhabi document. Do Pope Francis and the rest of the Catholic hierarchy proper understanding of Islam in the world and its doctrine?
Well, I don't know if I would be able to speak authoritatively for Pope Francis or the Catholic hierarchy. I do think that there is a broad misperception amongst many Catholics, and I'm sure probably some bishops and cardinals that probably think that if a message of peace and reconciliation is offered to Muslim leaders in the Muslim world, that maybe we would be able to get some progress and traction on more religious liberty in a number of these countries. But like I said at the beginning of the interview, it's very hard to find to be able to name a Muslim majority country, and certainly those where Islamic law is built into its constitution and laws. It's very hard to find an example of that where there isn't explicit marginalization of Christian communities, because that's the way it's been in Islam since the very beginning. The example that's often held up of Spain in the Middle Ages when, you know, a good part of the country was Islam. Recent scholars have been able to demonstrate that that wasn't really even the case there, that even then Christians and Jews suffered tremendously in the I think it was called the Almohad Empire in Spain. So I think that Catholics and all Americans and Westerners need to understand that this is very much built into Islamic self-understanding. So it would be this is a steep hill to climb if the goal is simply to, you know, try to persuade Muslim nations to play nicer with Christian communities.
Yeah, and you note in the book the very famous case in 2016 of this in Indonesia. His nickname was Ahok. I forget his actual much longer name. You know, he got into trouble, was prosecuted and convicted for blasphemy in Pakistan. I had to serve about a year-long prison sentence or so, you know, because he had ultimately come into had called the question a verse in the Quran saying that Muslims do not take Jews, Christians as friends, and he was arguing about how, well, you know, various Muslims will use this as an argument not for me. So, you know, Indonesia, as you and others have noted, you know, is often held up as this case of a tolerant Muslim society, but even there are limits. I mean, in your experience in Bangkok and in Southeast Asia, did you have much contact with Indonesia and deal with Christians there?
Yeah, I was able to travel to Indonesia twice, which is part of the reason I was familiar with the story of Ahok. And like you said, Andrew, I think it is demonstrative of, you know, what's at stake, even in the more, you know, quote-unquote liberal, democratic Muslim societies. Indonesia has a very large Christian population. I want to say it's perhaps 8 to 10% of the population. Indonesia is actually, folks probably don't know, it's one of the largest countries in the world, not just by not by landmass, but by population. I want to say something like 240 million people. So the Christian population is sizable, which is why you could have a governor of the capital, Jakarta, who is a Christian. But I think that case is so revealing because it was obvious that he was being viewed as a potential successor to Joko Widodo, the president of Indonesia, who's a Muslim. And I think there was a real fear that, oh my gosh, like this Muslim majority country with Muslim laws could suddenly be governed by a Christian. And so they, you know, create this doctored video you know, falsely accuse him of blasphemy. And he was convicted, which is it's very unnerving and depressing.
You're right. You talk about in the book about this doctor of a video that tried to make Ahok statements much more controversial, really present as a blasphemer. So you're saying that you probably think that there's really an effort to get this guy, you know, Muslim parties leaders saying, you know, we just can't have a Christian having this important critical post in such a Muslim country like Indonesia.
Oh, yeah. I think that without a doubt, that certainly would motivated the particular gentleman, or, well, not, he wasn't really a gentleman, who doctored the video, but many of the political parties that, you know, were threatening to lynch him and personally attacking him and ruin his career.
Well, you note in the book that, you know, the Christian population of Malaysia is about, you know, around 10% or so. Somewhat similar, I guess you might think, to Egypt. There, the Christian Coptic community in Egypt is also estimated about maybe 10 plus, you know, maybe 15% or so of the population. Has there ever been any high-ranking Christian official in Indonesia?
There are Christians that are, I think, I don't know if they're still on Joko Widodo's cabinet, but I know that, you know, I think his cabinet maybe had like 20 or 30 people, and I think maybe two or three of them were Christians. That's very unusual. It's usually a very small minority. And I think that Joko Widodo doing that was even itself, a bit surprising. But he was very much viewed as more of a liberal secularizing force. People joked in Southeast Asia that he was kind of like the Indonesian Barack Obama. In places like Indonesia, even where there is, even in Pakistan, right, there was a senior official in the government who was a Christian. But I think a lot of Muslims in those countries view that with disdain, and there's an eager desire to get them out of office.
Right, Shahbaz Bhatti again was the I mixed up before, I think, Shahbaz Bhatti with the Christian who is in the government of Pakistan, who is the minister for religious minorities. And then before him, he was assassinated in 2011, right after, a month before, the governor of Punjab, who was Salman Taseer. And they both were assassinated because of their voice opposition, criticism to the blasphemy law of Pakistan. So, yeah, that is indeed a rare occurrence to have such a Christian in a high rank in such a Muslim-majority country like Pakistan or for that matter, even Indonesia. Well, looking closer home, when we've talked about Pope Francis and dealing with Islam, what do you think about interfaith initiatives here among Christians and Muslims in the United States or elsewhere in other Western countries? I mean, you talk in your book, you go into such great detail, as you've indicated, about how the cross is actually so hated among Muslims. How should then Christians approach any such interfaith initiatives here in the United States with Muslims?
Well, I think that Christians always need to act with charity towards to Muslims or, you know, any people that we're called to. That is the calling that our Lord Jesus Christ has given to us. So I think part of what charity means also is ensuring that we properly understand our religious interlocutors, people who have different religious beliefs and opinions than us, including Muslims. And, you know, in the many years that I've been, you know, studying Islam and comparing it to Christianity and writing articles and now a book about the subject, I think there are a lot of misperceptions amongst Christians regarding Islam, and maybe sometimes a desire to do quick point scoring rather than truly understand Islam. I think it goes a long way when Christians are able to demonstrate that they really truly have tried to understand Islam and faithfully reflect that in their communication with Muslims. I think that goes a long way to facilitating religious dialogue, but, you know, ultimately, hopefully, converting them and persuading them of the truths of Christianity in the era of Islam. But in the sense of, do I think that, you know, is there great hope that religious dialogue between Christians and Muslims can resolve some of these, these violent issues in places like Pakistan, Iraq, Indonesia? No, I don't have a lot of optimism regarding that because, you know, like I said, and as I argue in The Persecuted, it's really baked into the cake of Islam. Muhammad, felt very strongly about Christianity as an inferior religion and had hatred for the cross, and so did his followers and successors. So I don't know how Muslims would be able to overcome that except by, in some senses, repudiating or at least diminishing their own religious traditions.
Well, I guess one last question then, looking abroad then, you talk in Pakistan about how, for example, the police are often very abusive toward Christians, that, you know, they want filed charges if they're abused or they demand bribes or whatever. How should a country like the United States deal with a country like Pakistan to try to, influence that country and change things there, given such, as you say, baked in the cake prejudices and practices in Pakistan?
Well, I would love for the U.S. government to invest as much energy in talking about religious liberty as it does now about talking about sexual identity and gender identity. You know, as someone who's, I've spent a good bit of time overseas and I've seen U.S. embassies, and, you know, they get really excited about Pride Month, you know, in every June, and the flags go up. You don't see as much emphasis from U.S. embassies on, protecting the rights of the religious minorities in these various nations. So I would love to see, some more, at least some parity, if not, you know, a larger emphasis on, what Christian minority communities are truly suffering in these places.
All right. Well, excellent. Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to Casey J. Chalk, who's a contributing editor of the New Oxford Review and a senior contributor for the Federalist, as well as contributing to American Conservative and Crisis Magazine. And he's come out now with a new book, The Persecuted: True Stories of Courageous Christians Living Their Faith in Muslim Lands, an excellent book which I'd recommend. Well, Casey, thank you for joining the show.
It's my pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, that was excellent. And for our listeners out there, tune in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harris, where we like to discuss important issues for conservatives and others. Thank you very much.